Oh yay, the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are Nair S. Benurum, M.D. versus Donna Jacobo, Jefferson County and the 10th Appellate District, Volkswagen of America Incorporated versus Andrew Ramirez Sr. and others from the Valdo County, the 13th Appellate District, and City of Dallas versus Interstate Contracting Corporation, a certified question from the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. In each matter, we've allotted 20 minutes for petitioner or appellant to present their argument, 20 minutes for their response. Petitioner may reserve a portion of time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. Justice Owen is not participating in the oral arguments today because of a family emergency. The court is ready to hear Owen. We are recording these arguments, and you may purchase a tape of any argument from our clerk. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Viner versus Jacobo.
May it please the court, Mr. Brent Cooper will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. There are really two issues in this case that we'd like to address in oral argument. The first is the ability of a party in Texas to combine a no evidence and traditional motion for summary judgment together. The second concerns the scope and extent and duty with respect to informed consent.
If we agreed with you on the first,
I will go to Nicholson.
Then would the proper remedy not be a remand to the Court of Appeals?
For consideration
of the no evidence portion of the motion.
First off, we believe that we satisfied our burden with respect to the traditional motion, since it has not been considered by the...
Well, if you did that, then you can go ahead and make your main argument.
Correct. But on that point alone, yes, then it would be to send it back to the Court of Appeals for consideration with respect to the no evidence motion for summary judgment.
Okay.
Now, we believe that Texas rules civil procedure does allow the combination, and very, very briefly, because I think it is pretty much without dispute, the combination is not prohibited by the rules. The combination of these two motions is consistent, we believe, with the purpose and the spirit of the rules. Also, with this court's notes and comments which accompany the rules, we believe it's consistent with that. So far, 13 of the 14 courts of appeals in this state have allowed and have reviewed motions for summary judgment that had both traditional and no evidence points without any problem.
It seems to me that the point you make is valid, that they ought to be able to bring both motions together. But if it is a motion that you take the burden to establish or disestablish one of the elements of the plaintiff's claim, the respondent to that doesn't have to file a response. And
correct.
They can argue that you didn't get there on what you attempt. But if you say they can't or they don't have any evidence of any particular element of their claim, they have a duty to respond, otherwise they lose.
That's correct.
So it may be that the CA is incorrect to be so strict on how this is done, but shouldn't there still be some requirement on the movement to make sure that their motion is clear to the respondent that they're going to have a duty to respond? In other words, they can't say, well, we've got all this evidence that disproves their elements, and oh, by the way, they don't have any evidence that proves it, and then you go back to the big print, and they therefore lose on a no evidence that they really didn't have any notice that they had a duty to respond to.
I have no question. There's no doubt in my mind that the non-movement should have noticed. Here, though, in the motion for summary judgment that was filed by Dr. Benure, there were separate sections. There was a traditional section. where the evidence was discussed. And then there was a separate section talking about a motion for summary judgment under 166AI. So clearly, in this case, the non-movement was put on notice, and that was section 4 of the motion for summary judgment, where they talked about the standard for review of a motion for summary judgment under 166AI, and they talked about that there was no evidence under, again, Dr. Bernier is entitled to summary judgment under 166AI as to all the plaintiff's claims because there's no evidence to show that informed consent was not given. Also, there's no evidence to show proximate causation. So I agree in concept, Justice Enick, that there should be notice. In this case, there clearly was notice because it was contained in a separate section. And so we believe it should have been considered. We also believe that, again, the plaintiff in this case did fail to respond. There was no response filed with respect to proximate causation, which was raised. And for this reason, we believe that the Court of Appeals erred in failing to affirm the judgment of the trial court in light of the fact that no response was filed as required by the comments and as required by this court in McConnell and as required by Rule 166A, that you've got to file a response. You've got to set out what are the fact issues that would defeat our motion for summary judgment. And so we believe that it's fatal, there was no response filed, and that the Court of Appeals erred in failing to consider it, and then on remand should go ahead and grant the motion or affirm the summary judgment that was granted by the trial court. Now, the second point that I want to raise, unless there's some more questions regarding the no evidence summary judgment, concerns informed consent. And we believe that the Court of Appeals in this case misconstrued Texas law regarding informed consent. And what they have done is they have attempted to miscast and recast what is allegations of misdiagnosis or unnecessary surgery as lack of informed consent.
Do you agree with everything in the dissenting justice's opinion?
I believe we do. The dissent said, as presented, the evidence in this case really is about negligent diagnosis and recommended course of treatment, not informed consent. In Texas, as this court is well aware, under 6.02 of Article 4590I, the legislature has very narrowly crafted what is allowable in an informed consent case in Texas. And the legislature has said back in 1977 that the only theory with respect to informed consent is the failure of a physician to disclose the risks and hazards of a proposed procedure or surgery. That is it. And what the court, what the majority in the Court of Appeals has done in this case has said, well, the plaintiff has said that the surgery was unnecessary and therefore there should have been disclosure about the fact that the surgery was unnecessary and therefore there was not informed consent. And you think about it. If that is the law, then in effect the court is adopting a strict liability for physicians and for surgeons with respect to perhaps misdiagnosis or unnecessary surgery, because clearly, if the surgery wasn't necessary, nobody in their right mind would say, well, if you told me it was unnecessary, I would have gone ahead and consented to it. They said, of course not. I never would have consented. And yet, the standard with respect to either misdiagnosis or unnecessary surgery is whether or not the physician followed the standard of care. On many occasions, a doctor will not know what is the situation until, for example, he's gone in and done exploratory surgery. And the question is, did the doctor follow the standard of care in making the decision to go forward with the procedure? And if it turns out that the procedure was unnecessary because the condition that he thought existed did not exist, then all the plaintiff would have to do is say, well, it was unnecessary surgery. You never told me it was unnecessary. If you told me it was unnecessary, I never would have consented. Therefore, we don't have informed consent. Therefore, doctor, you're liable, and we're entitled to recover.
Mr. Cook, let me ask you a question. Can you imagine any circumstance under which a doctor could puff to the extent that you would not come under the informed consent statute, such as your real need for this type of surgery, what can it do for you?
Again,
not so much need, but what it can do for you, almost a misrepresentation.
A doctor can do that, and there are cases which say that if a doctor does that, as far as misrepresenting the need for surgery, that is actionable. That is actionable as misrepresentation or unnecessary surgery, but it's not actionable under the theory of informed consent. And again, the question would be whether or not the doctor followed the standard of care in recommending the surgery for this particular condition or ailment. And again, there's been at least four courts of appeals that we have cited decisions in our brief. The best one is Patton versus St. Joseph's Hospital out of Fort Worth, where the Fort Worth court said, and it involved unnecessary laparoscopic surgery or allegations of unnecessary laparoscopic surgery. And the Fort Worth court there said, under Patton's argument, she would want this court to hold a doctor liable under an informed consent theory whenever a patient is misdiagnosed and an unnecessary surgery is performed. The Medical Act 4599 simply doesn't provide that. There have been other courts, the Houston First Court of Appeals in Nebel versus Sepulveda, the Houston 14th Court in Marling versus Mallard held the same thing. The Houston 14th Court earlier in Brown versus Armstrong also held that when you're talking about unnecessary surgery or misdiagnosis, it is not informed consent.
Does Peterson versus Shields, how does that impact this case? Is it possible to say that under that decision there is room for a claim just like this?
Peterson versus Shields, again, is governed by Section 6.02 of Article 4599. And what Peterson versus Shields does, it talks about, first off, if you're in List A, which are those procedures where the panel has prescribed the informed consent. Then there's panel B where no informed consent is necessary. Then you have those procedures where there is no listing under panel A or panel B. And what Peterson versus Shields says is under 4590I, under 6.02, if you're not under List A, if you're not under List B, then the standard is for informed consent is what are the risks that would be reasonably disclosed by a physician that would reasonably influence a person in withholding or granting consent. But it goes to the risk inherent to the procedure itself, again, because it tracks what is contained in Article 6.02 of Article 4599.
Okay. On the issue of consent, let's assume that is exploratory surgery. And let's assume that we don't know. The doctor doesn't know. The patient doesn't know if they'll find anything. But the doctor thinks that they ought to go look for it. Suppose the doctor fails to tell the patient that we may not find anything. Suppose the doctor fails to inform the patient that I think, based on what I see, it's my recommendation to go forward with surgery because this is really important to do. But in the medical community, it's known that the exploratory surgery doesn't necessarily find it. It's just one of the avenues you could use. And you go in and you don't find it. Does the patient have a claim against the doctor for having failed to fully inform, because all the doctor said is this is necessary in order to do an appropriate, looking at this, but failed to inform them that, in 50% of the cases we don't find anything, but that's just the way it is. Can you rely on the fact that proper medical standard would say yes, you should have performed the procedure, even though the patient was not fully informed about it may not be necessary?
First, I don't think that would fall within informed consent, because informed consent is the risk inherent to the procedure. The doctor has a duty under 602 to inform the patient of the risks that are inherent to the procedure. That is, something that bad could happen from doing this procedure, not whether or not the procedure should or should not be performed to begin with. And again, I think those types of cases under Mallard, under Brown, under Hatton, would be under a misrepresentation, would be under unnecessary surgery, but would not be under informed consent. No Texas court has recognized that type of case as being under informed consent because of the narrow construct that has been given to us by our legislature. And that gets to under the traditional motion for summary judgment that we raised, the last point I would cover because of the last.
Mr. Cooper, let's go back to your statement that to take the position of the Court of Appeals is to convert every case of this sort into a strict liability case against doctors. It may be that this type of case, where the allegation of the plaintiff is that there was a overstatement of the need for the double simple mastectomy, is an informed consent case, as the plaintiff has alleged. It may be that that's actionable under 6.02, and it may not be. I'm not sure yet. But the purpose of informed consent is to make sure that the patient has information, accurate information, within reason, to make a decision to have the procedure or not, correct? Given that purpose, which you've stated already this morning, why is it not possible, at least conceptually, that overstating the need for a procedure would mean that the consent given was not informed consent?
Informed consent is to state accurately the risks inherent for the procedure. Not necessarily the need for the procedure, because again, I think misstating the need for the procedure again goes back to the standard of care. And it may be that about the doctor overstating the need for the procedure may not have followed the standard of care. If there was only a 3% risk of whatever condition happening, and the doctor says, Justice Wainwright, you really need to have this because of your condition, you could die. Now, the question is, did the doctor follow the standard of care in stating the need for the procedure? And if he has overstated the fact that you only had a 3% risk of this condition, and he said, you know, you may die from it, then that may go to the standard of care as far as recommending and going forward with the surgery. But again, it doesn't have to do with the risk inherent from the procedure, because in order to connect the dots.
So your point is a misrepresentation about the need for a procedure may be actionable. Maybe not, but it's not actionable under 6.02.
Correct. It may be actionable under the standard of care. You've got to connect the dots between the surgical procedure and a risk that results from the surgical procedure. And we don't have that in your situation. We don't have that in this case.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready for your argument.
May it please the court. Mr. Paul Waldner will present argument for response.
May I please the court?
Why is this case presented to us only as an informed consent?
Because if you take all of the facts and all of this paper and all of the law that we've presented, both sides presented to the courts, everything that happened in the trial, every affidavit, all the testimony, all the depositions, and distill it down, there's one thing that's accountable for what happened to Donna Jacobo. And that was her doctor told her, if you don't have this surgery, it's a certainty that you'll have cancer. The information that he gave her, which formulated the basis for obtaining her consent, is the heart of this
entire thing. How is that different from a misdiagnosis?
Well, it would be different, Justice Hecht, from a misdiagnosis from the standpoint that in this case there was no diagnosis. For example,
isn't that a misdiagnosis?
I don't believe they're the same thing. If you take the cases that have been presented by Dr. Benoor to the court, you know, having to do with performing surgery to remove a lymph gland when it was actually an infection, performing surgery to remove an appendix when there was nothing wrong with the appendix, those are misdiagnosis cases where there's been a definitive diagnosis, and based on that diagnosis, a course of treatment has been followed. In this case, there was no diagnosis. Donna Jacobo wasn't injured. She wasn't ill. She had no disease of any kind. So there's no diagnosis to then become a misdiagnosis in her case.
Except that, then you've described everything that she knew before she had the surgery. Aren't you describing that she knew that she didn't have cancer before she had the surgery?
Yes, sir. She knew she didn't have cancer and had been told that she would get it.
Okay. And she had the surgery because she understood that in that doctor's medical judgment, she was, well, had a chance of getting cancer?
Yes,
or
sir.
Was going to get cancer?
Was going to get.
There are studies out there that say that there's a genetic link in breast cancer, certain types of breast cancer, not all, but certain types of breast cancer, that if you have, if your mother had breast cancer, the daughter will get breast cancer. Is that, I mean, is that what this issue is about? She didn't have that that genetic link, or somehow the doctor made a misdiagnosis. Isn't the issue here that the doctor was saying she'd get cancer, but she was not one of those patients who would?
Well,
is that what the issue is?
There are studies, and there was medical evidence, you know, having to do with certain familial traits that may increase your chance of developing cancer. That was in the evidence at the trial court. What Donna was told, it's 100% for you. What the trial testimony showed, it was less than 8%.
But
given the risk factor.
Isn't there a diagnostic element to that, predicting future possibilities or probabilities? It sounds to me like your definition of diagnosis has to be of an existing condition, and it can't be predicting the future of somebody's genetic predisposition. It seems to me that what happens in the future has an element of diagnostic evaluation to it.
Well, there may be an element involved in that the physician is talking to her about a disease. But it's not a diagnosis, because a diagnosis, and I set out in our brief, you know, the definition of that term, you know, the diagnosis, you know, has to do with the definitive medical opinion with regard to a condition that exists, that which will then formulate the basis for treatment. That's not what we're dealing with. All we're dealing with is a woman who had a lump in her breast and went to her doctor. She had had two previous lumps in her breast, which had been removed and were benign. And then when she was referred to Dr. Benour, and Dr. Benour sat down and talked to her about her cancer risk, he admitted that he did not take a full history from her that would be necessary to determine the extent to which she was at risk for developing cancer. He admitted that.
But
the summary judgment evidence is...
Then wouldn't your proof against Dr. Benour be another medical expert who comes in and says his evaluation of the patient and his determination to recommend surgery was beneath the standard of care in the medical community? Wouldn't that be the element of evidence in this case?
Yes, and we have that from Dr. Sharon Webb, who's a professor of plastic and reconstructive surgery. But what Dr. Webb pointed out is that Dr. Benour, even stated himself that would be beneath the standard of care to make that representation. He denies those are the words he spoke, but that's the summary judgment evidence that he spoke.
And so isn't that a medical malpractice case? Isn't that the case that she had unnecessary surgery because the doctor did not do his proper medical evaluation?
If I could restate that a little bit. She had unnecessary surgery because the doctor gave her information that was wrong, that formulated the basis for her to consent to the procedure.
But the information was based on improper medical evaluation.
Improper medical evaluation. It was based on whatever was going on in Dr. Benour's practice that day, to tell a patient that it's not a question of if you will acquire cancer, it's a question of when you will develop the disease.
Let's assume that Dr. Smith provided the proper information for informed consent. Not Dr. Benour, but Dr. Smith provided that. Let's also assume that Dr. Smith, that you would agree that Dr. Smith was the surgeon for the mastectomy.
Yes, sir.
Does your case go away?
If Dr. Smith gave her the proper information with regard to her cancer risk, yes, sir, it does.
It's your contention that Dr. Benour was the surgeon for the mastectomy, not just the assistant surgeon, and he had the obligation to provide the information. Even if the proper information came from Dr. Smith, because it didn't come from Dr. Benour, Dr. Benour is liable here? Is that your position?
I think that if Donna Jacobo had been given the proper information, and the information extends in considering the Carp versus Cooley cases and the Wilson versus Scott cases that are cited not just by the Waco court but by Dr. Benour and his brief, that the requirement that information be given is not just about the procedure that's going to be done, but it goes to options. And it says that in the consent form, and they pointed that out. What are your alternatives? One of your alternatives is not to have the surgery. And so the risk and hazard of not having the surgery is part of the informed consent process. Now, if I understand your question correctly, and I'll try to give you an answer to it, that if you're asking, if Dr. Schmidt had given the proper information to Donna Jacoba, you have a slight increase in cancer risk because of your family history. The increase in risk is about 8%. Now, under those circumstances, I would recommend this surgery to you. If she had been given that information, then the whole case goes if she consented to the surgery with that information. But Donna Jacobo and every patient is entitled not just to information about the risk and hazards of the procedure, but the risk and hazards of not having the procedure. What risk am I at if I don't consent to this?
So your contention is that Dr. Smith did not give the plaintiff appropriate information about the need for the surgery, and Dr. Bonneur overstated the need for the procedure.
Yes, sir. As a matter of fact, Dr. Schmidt, in his trial testimony that I cited in our brief to the court, said, I'm not the one that pushed her into this surgery. I sent her to the plastic surgeon, and that's where she discussed consent with him.
That's a bit odd, isn't it, for the plastic surgeon, if you're talking about the need for a mastectomy?
Other than the fact that
the patient had a surgeon who talked to her about that?
Well, Donna Jacobo's affidavit and her summary judgment proof and her trial testimony and her deposition all said that when this was first presented to her by Dr. Schmidt, that she thought it was extreme. She didn't want to have anything to do with it. But when she was referred
she
to Dr. Bonneur,
extreme?
She thought it was extreme and didn't want, and she didn't consent to it until she was referred to Dr. Bonneur. Now, plastic and reconstructive surgeons do a lot of reconstructive surgery for women who have mastectomies. And as such, in the medical literature, you'll find a lot of articles about the issue having to do with prophylactic mastectomies that are written by plastic surgeons in plastic surgery journals.
Are you saying that you could not have brought your claim as a negligence cause of action or misdiagnosis under these facts?
Yes, sir.
And it's because there was no diagnosis?
Yes, sir.
Position. Okay.
Because with regard to the negligence, the mastectomies, as I pointed out in the brief, the mastectomies were done properly. There's no issue about the way in which the surgery was performed. The only issue that we present is has to do with the information that was given to her, the misinformation that she was given that formulated the basis for her consent.
Let's assume that, I mean, the doctor denies having given her that information, but we assume that, I mean, let's assume the doctor did give that information. Your point is that the doctor gave the information without a proper diagnosis. You say he didn't give a diagnosis, but I assume if he told her that she was going to get cancer and therefore need surgery, that was an improper diagnosis. He formed a medical judgment about the need for surgery based on a lack of information. And that'd be an improper diagnosis, wouldn't it?
No, sir. I don't agree with that. Yeah, because the diagnosis had to do, for example, on the consent form. She had, for diagnosis on the consent form, it said dense fibrocystic breast. That's correct. Most women, Sergeant Jacobo's age, have dense fibrocystic breasts, and that's a correct diagnosis.
Let me ask you, how is that different than a doctor who looks at the x-rays and says, you need surgery to repair that broken bone? And lo and behold, the bone's not broken. It has the information. And how is that not a, how does that not a misdiagnosis? I looked at the x-ray, I determined that's a broken bone, we've got to have surgery to repair the broken bone. You go in there and lo and behold, the bone's not broken.
I agree with that.
But is that a misdiagnosis or is that a lack of informed consent?
That's a misdiagnosis.
But isn't that based on an improper medical workup? I talked to the patient. I determined it was a broken bone. You got to have surgery. What makes that a misdiagnosis case and your case a lack of informed consent?
Because under those circumstances, to go with the broken leg, when the physician's looking at the x-ray, the physician is performing the clinical test, the physician is doing those things that are necessary to arrive at a diagnosis, and then arrives at a diagnosis that's not accurate, and based on an inaccurate diagnosis performs the procedure, that would be a misdiagnosis, therefore mistreatment, and negligence case. In this case, there were no tests done. There was no preoperative testing. You know, the only thing that happened is a partial history was taken. And and information, partial information was obtained, and then information was given to her. And the recommendation, Dr. Benor said, I recommended the entire procedure for her. And that was his testimony.
So the difference is that the doctor in the broken bone case actually looked at the x-ray. But if the doctor had not looked at the x-ray but simply had questioned, taken the personal history of the patient and determined that there was a broken bone that needed to be repaired, then that would be a lack of informed consent.
Yes.
So in this case, if he had looked at her x-rays and said, you do have cancer and it's advanced and we have to do this surgery, that would be a misdiagnosis.
Yes, it would. The distinction is, in this case, is that Donna's mom had cancer. Her risk is determined by when did she have cancer, pre or postmenopausal. If it was premenopausal, Donna's cancer risk goes up. If it was unilateral, it goes down. If it was bilateral, it goes up. Her grandmother had breast cancer. If it was premenopausal, Donna's risk goes down. If it's it goes up. If it's postmenopausal, it goes down. All of the history would lean, those questions were never asked. Had they been asked, the result would have been that her cancer risk was low, because her mom and her grandmother had postmenopausal breast cancer unilaterally, only on one side. Had that information been obtained, then the information given by Dr. Benor, hopefully, would not have been. It's not a question of if you get cancer, it's a question of when. He did not give her the proper information because he did not take the proper information from her. He didn't ask her the proper questions. And based on his recommendation to her, based on his statement to her that she will develop breast cancer if she didn't have this surgery, that's what the summary judgment evidence shows as to why she consented to the procedure. And that's why it comes under informed consent as opposed to a negligent misdiagnosis or negligent treatment.
The medical disclosure panel has provided for the disclosure of some risks of some diseases.
Yes, sir.
And if you do what they say, you discharged your duty under the statute. Are you aware of, there are quite a few of them, are you aware of any of them that require the kind of disclosure that you're talking about in this case?
No, sir. This surgery, the bilateral simple mastectomy that was done on Donna Jacoby, is not a list A or list B procedure.
No, but if you were going, it looks to me like you're saying this is just a common law of duty. And it looks to me like if you were making up list A, you would sure put this on there if you were right about it. On other diseases, pancreatitis, that happens to be on the list. Reconstruction of the orifice here. You know, there's lots of them in there. But it seems to me that if you were correct, surely under some of them, but maybe under all of them, you would say you've got to tell the patient all of the information available, and if you leave any out, that's a non-disclosure. Why wouldn't that be on one of the things you had to disclose?
Well, as you pointed out in the Earl versus Rattler case, when it was argued by the plaintiff in that case, even though it was a list A procedure in that case, the plaintiff argued there are additional risks that in fact happened, you know, that should have been disclosed. And as you wrote in that decision, Justice Heck, that would thwart the whole purpose of the Texas Medical Disclosure Act. That is to create a list of procedures, relatively common procedures, and those risks that the panel feels should be disclosed. And when the patient signs that, and the patient consents to surgery based on that disclosure, then the physician, at that point, is immune to informed consent liability.
Right.
And so...
So why would the panel put the thing that you think needs to be disclosed on the list under some disease?
Well, the panel reviews it once a year, and as the court knows, that's a dynamic list. It's not static, and certainly it could be. I can certainly assure the court that the whole concept of removing a woman's breast because she may develop cancer in the future is extremely controversial, and I don't know if that will ever make it on that list.
Well, there are some risks listed for mastectomy. But one of them, and maybe that's been added since, or maybe it doesn't apply here. But in all of these diseases, none of them say one of the things you have to tell the patient is all of the relevant information regarding whether the patient may or may not have the disease.
may or may not need the treatment, and the risk that they won't need the treatment. That's just not listed on the list anywhere, and I wonder if you have an explanation why the panel wouldn't put that on list A somewhere.
I don't know why they've chosen not to put that on there, but the effect is that this case is relegated as a non-list case. It's relegated to a negligence standard, you know, that has to do with the disclosure, you know, of that information that would influence the reasonable person as to whether or not to consent to a procedure. And in this case, you know, had the disclosure to Donna Jacobo been, look, your cancer risk is higher because of the presence of cancer in your family, but it's a little bit less than 8%. Now, would the reasonable patient want to hear that before she consents to a procedure, you know, to remove a breast from her body, as opposed to it's a life or death situation. If you don't have the surgery, you're going to get cancer.
Well, that seems to be hard to imagine you wouldn't want to hear that. The only question is that lack of informed consent, or is that a failure to abide by the standard of care? That's our concern. Not that you wouldn't want to hear it. Of course you'd want to hear it.
And I think, as I stated earlier, that under the Carp and Wilson cases, you know, those cases discuss, you know, the duty of informed consent goes both ways. It has to do with informing the patient about the risk and hazards, you know, of the procedure itself, but also the risk and hazards, as this consent form in this case mentions, the risk and hazards of not having the procedure. Because there are risks. Even if her cancer risk is less than 8%, there is a risk she should know about in not having her breast preventatively removed from her body.
Is it too late for you to amend to allege a misdiagnosis case? Would that relate back to your original petition?
I'm not certain, to be honest. I'm not certain.
Would you spend a moment or two addressing why Waco's right, everybody else in the class is wrong?
Well, to be quite honest with you, that with regard to the summary judgment issue, I'm impressed with Dr. Vanier's brief on it. When you look at all the holdings in all the courts of appeals, where some courts said, well, it should be delineated carefully. Some say it should be filed in two different motions. It seems it's all over the map. You know, I'm convinced that the practitioners in this state need some guidance, you know, with regard to what this court expects as to delineating between a traditional summary judgment motion and a no evidence.
In that respect, then, what would you say about their argument that you failed to adduce evidence of proximate cause?
Well, that argument's inaccurate, you know, because in our response to motion for summary judgment, that on pages 1, 2, 4, 8, 9, 13, it's all argued that Donna Jacobo only had this surgery because of the information given to her by Dr. Vanier. Additionally, there are references made to her affidavit, and no one's questioned her affidavit. And in her affidavit, she said unequivocally, I would have never had this surgery had I not been told that information by Dr. Vanier, because when Dr. Schmidt first suggested it without telling me I was going to die from cancer, you know, I thought it was too extreme, and then I chose not to consent at that point.
Do you know whether the federal court practice is to separate out different kinds of motions?
No, sir. I'm sorry. I know.
File them separately, flag them. They've had the same practice since 1986.
I must.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your
Honor.
A couple of points I'd like to address. First is, their response to the summary judgment, to the either the no evidence or the traditional motion for summary judgment. First off, proximate causation is not addressed in the response. You read it, you won't see it mentioned. Number two is, we don't believe him. If you look at her affidavit, it doesn't go to the issue of informed consent for the reasons we've been talking about, because it doesn't go to the risk inherent to the procedure. Number three, this court in Peterson versus Shields said on page 931 that if it's not list A or list B, the plaintiff must prove by expert testimony that the medical condition complained of is a risk inherent in the medical procedure performed. The expert should also testify to all of the facts concerning the risk which show that the knowledge of the risk could influence a reasonable person in making a decision to consent to the procedure. There is no expert testimony, as required by Peterson versus Shield. They failed in the burden of coming forward with the evidence. Second point I want to address is concerning the informed consent, and that is this was a prophylactic mastectomy. Everybody knew she didn't have breast cancer. Everybody knew that the cyst or the mass was fibroid. Therefore, when you're talking about a prophylactic procedure, it necessarily involves the judgment of the physician as far as the future care, the future history of this person. It involves diagnostic skills as far as whether or not this person is a likely candidate in the future to get breast cancer. You're calling for the judgment and skill of the physician in making that decision and in making that recommendation concerning any prophylactic procedure. It goes to diagnosis. It is a misdiagnosis, if that's what you're trying to claim, because it involves the judgment of the physician with respect to whether or not this person is a likely candidate in the future. Now, on the issue of informed consent, she did sign an informed consent form that was obtained by Dr. Schmidt, page 504 and 05 of the record. The signature was witnessed as required by 4590I. If you look at the consent form, she acknowledged that her doctor described the risk, complications, and consequences of the proposed surgery, which is what's required by an informed consent form. She also states in her informed consent form that Dr. Schmidt discussed alternatives available and the risks, complications, and consequences, including the option of no surgery. She signed this, admitted to this, 2 days before she had the mastectomy on March 17th of 1993.
Do you know of anything that would prevent her from amending her petition to allege misdiagnosis?
Well, the only thing that was pending at the time that the summary judgment was informed consent. We moved for summary judgment. They had waived the remaining claims before the summary judgment at the trial. There were other claims that were post-surgical claims. All the other claims had been waived, and that's going to be found on page...
waived or not?
Yes, they were waived. And so the only thing, in fact, if you look at the Court of Appeals opinion, it says, everyone agrees that the only asserted cause of action was informed consent. That's in the dissent. It's also...
But that doesn't answer the question of whether there could be an amendment now.
Well, except, though, we had moved for summary judgment, and if we're correct, that would dispose of the case because it would have disposed of all claims that were pending at the time we moved for summary judgment. And the question is, can a party, after summary judgment has been granted and gone to the Court of Appeals and go up to the Supreme Court, come back later on and amend their petition once more to assert something perhaps they could have? I don't think Texas law allows that. I think Texas law requires that before your summary judgment is heard and granted, you have to put out all your possible causes of action, and if you don't, then you can't come back after you've gone up on appeal and try to reassert them at that point.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first part. The court will take a brief recess.